So, after losing the 60th vote in the Senate, Democrats went into super slow-mo mode as far as health care reform is concerned. The president still thinks it's a priority, and there are some in the Senate, including Dick Durbin from Illinois, who believes the clock is still ticking.
For those who say, start over, let's start at the beginning, let's do a little bit, let's maybe do nothing, some say, I would just tell them, if we do nothing, the Medicare Trust Fund will be exhausted in 7 years. The plan we have before the Senate would extend the life of Medicare for 9 more years. If we do nothing, there'll be 57 million Americans uninsured instead of 47 million in just a few years.
Well, the future of Medicare is just one of the things we want to talk about with David Leonard, economics correspondent and columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you, John?
So we famously have heard over these past several months that healthcare is a sixth of the economy. That puts it squarely in your bailiwick. Is there a virtue in starting over, and where could this go from here?
If they start over, we're not going to get much of a health reform bill, and there are two main reasons for that. One, the Republicans are not really interested in working with the Democrats on this. We've seen that over the last year, and there's no reason to think that changes now because their strategy has worked pretty well politically. So I don't think they're going to start working with the Democrats now on this. And the second reason is it's really hard to do pieces of health reform. Let's say you tell the insurers they can't select people based on pre-existing conditions. Well, then you have the problem that a lot of the sickest people will be the ones signing up for insurance, and the cost of insurance goes way up. And the way you deal with that adverse selection is you mandate everyone gets insurance, so you don't have just the sickest signing up. But if you mandate everyone gets insurance, then you need to give people subsidies, and then you end up with a bill that looks a lot like what the Senate and the House have passed. And so if we start at the drawing board, we're going to end up with a really narrow, far, far, far more minor bill than what we've had so far.
So let me just recapitulate. If you don't do mandates, the cost goes way up because the sickest people get involved. If you do mandates without subsidies, it won't necessarily be effective, and you'll end up with an unfunded mandate anyway, kind of like the Medicaid problem that the states are dealing with. What sorts of policy issues in the current bill can be preserved and moved forward?
You can do little things. I mean, after the Clinton health reform changed, they did S-CHIP, right? They made it a lot easier for poor kids to get insurance, and you can come up with smaller subsidies. You can put in some regulation of the insurance companies so that, for example, there are lifetime caps on how much people can spend over the course of their lifetime. But none of that deals with the two fundamental problems we have with healthcare, which is, one, it's so expensive that it's sapping workers' wages and that it's causing Medicare to go broke and it's creating all these problems. And two, which is really in many ways an outgrowth of one, we have tens of millions of uninsured people. And so we could get a bill that does some little things here and there, but we're not going to get a bill that deals with those two fundamental problems if we start from the drawing board and do something really small.
Well, if you listen to the president last week, he genuinely sounded upset and kind of heartbroken over all this. I guess I'm wondering why, at the end of the day, there isn't more clarity about what we need to do or when we need to do it. It seems to me this whole debate and the way that it was run has given us a lack of clarity, a sense of frustration, and a lot of independents just walked away.
Well, I mean, health reform was always going to be a messy process, right, for a couple different reasons. One, as some people like to point out, legislation is unpopular and programs are popular. So the mere process of crafting legislation is never something that really gets voters excited or quite frankly, even happy. It involves horse trading. No one really knows what's going on. And so it's clear at this point, in retrospect, but I also think it's clear to criticize the White House and Congress on this. They just took too long on this. And I don't know that there's a way to run the legislative process that would be a lot more popular. They just let it drag out for too long. Now, some people think that because there isn't some great secret solution that works a lot better than the legislation that we just got to, some people think that at the end of the day, the House is going to look at this Senate bill, and they're going to say, wait a second, this bill covers 30 million people. Well more than half of the projected uninsured. And not only does it do that, but it more than pays the $1 trillion in costs for covering those people. In fact, over the next 20 years, it reduces overall health spending by $1 trillion, despite adding all these new people into the system. And our are the Democrats really going to vote down this bill or not vote it up in the House because the House has been mistreated by the Senate during this process?
So that's the no re-vote scenario in the Senate. You say fear by Democrats in the House of doing nothing will motivate them to come across and actually put this into law?
I'm not saying it will. I'm saying that if you want to come up with a scenario in which this still actually happens and passes, it's that. It's that House Democrats look at this and they say, we're going to cover 30 million people, we're going to do it while reducing the deficit, according to what the CBO says, and we still wouldn't vote for this bill because it's not our first choice. At the end of the day, when that's the choice, and it is the choice, some people think the House, there's a chance that the House is still going to approve this.
Well, we'll see if the president in his State of the Union address on Wednesday can actually raise the voltage of some of that fear among Democrats in the House. David Leonhardt, New York Times economics columnist. Thanks so much.
If you missed anything, take a look at our website. You can take our podcast there at thetakeaway.org. We're looking ahead to the State of the Union address later this week, and we're talking to people like Homeland Secretary Janet Napolitano and General David Petraeus, but we want to know what you think. In six words or less, what's the State of the Union? Diane writes to our Facebook page, spiraling into entropy, both sides culpable.
Nice.
And Omar's been getting a little creative. He has a lot of suggestions on our website, thetakeaway.org. One of them, challenging both sides to action over inaction. Let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or our site, thetakeaway.org. A special welcome this morning to our expanded listening audience in New York, starting this week on for four full hours every morning on our home station, WNYC AM 820.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.